Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guests on this episode are Dan Rathbun, Michael Melender, Nils Frichtl, and Wes Anderson of Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum. The group is currently celebrating 25 years as a band, and this fall they'll re-release their first three LPs on vinyl inside the U.S. for the first time as part of a box set called Triptych. We talked about the band's history, its employment of homemade instruments, its enduring appeal, and how Wes Anderson joining the group has impacted how they play. That's Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum on Into Music, coming up now. I guess I wanted to just talking about live performance, just go back a little bit to the shows that happened in 2024. You know, just kind of ask what inspired that kind of reemergence for the band and what you discovered when you got out on the road and started playing in front of audiences again. Dan, do you want to start with that one?
Well, what inspired the reemergence? I guess just everybody felt able to approach it. We didn't stop playing together because we disliked each other and we didn't have artistic differences. It just was people's lives were going in different directions. And it was, you know, with half the band on the East Coast, it felt like impractical to continue to be a band. Okay. And then everyone had, well, not everyone, sorry, Michael, had children. And that took up a lot of everyone's time and energy. We actually started talking about it, I think, all the way back, maybe even as early as 2019, we sort of said, hey, how about a Sleepy Time reunion? And then COVID hit. And that ended that thought.
It's something that we'd always intended to kind of regroup as we had most of a record recorded. Yeah, it was always going to happen where we were going to come back together to finish the record and do some shows. It was just a matter of when and how. So it was never a question as to if. It was just when and how.
And then the immediate thing that precipitated it was Carla was speaking with somebody from the Big Ears Festival, and just hypothetically the idea of a Sleepy Time reunion came up, and they said, oh yeah, let's do that. And so we're like, well, why don't we just use this as an excuse to make it happen? I mean, just one gig is not really enough to make a reunion happen, but we just decided to call it enough and go for it.
My sense is that sometimes when a band has a hiatus or a breakup or whatever, there's often they get back out there and they discover that there's an audience that's grown in the time that they've been absent. Is that kind of what you saw?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely an audience that another generation that had picked it up and started checking it out. Every night, and you know, ongoingly, every night there's people are saying, I can't believe I'm getting a chance to see you guys live. I've been listening to you since I was 10 or since I was 12, right when you broke up, and now they're 20 or 21 or 32, which is really great to be playing for those people. Really, really exciting to have it be passed around to another generation.
Yeah, sometimes literally, like just like families of mm-hmm. Sleepy Time enthusiasts, you know.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Take our kids.
In Phoenix, there was like grandma, mom, and granddaughter, all three at the show. Really sweet.
What do you think, like, kind of has had that cross-generational appeal for, you know, for audiences? Is it the kind of eclecticism? Do you think it's the performance factor?
Well, I think the one thing is universal, and that is if you carefully make music that you really mean, it shows. You know, there's all kinds of timeless albums made by people who really, really put their heart and soul into it. And those things are, I think, things that we do also. So I sort of, I don't know, I couldn't say, who can say what percentage of, I mean, but there's people who love it without ever having seen it live. So I can't, you can't explain it just by the fact that we are flamboyant looking, although we are.
Lovely plumage, Dan.
Yeah, thank you.
The other thing that's happening, of course, is the reissue of the first three albums in this box set, first time in the U.S. on vinyl. You know, if we can go back to like when Grand Opening and Closing came out, that was, I was telling somebody the other day that that record to me was like, wasn't like I found it. It was almost like it found me. And I thought, oh, this is so, this is the thing that I've been looking for at this moment in time. Do you remember like kind of the making and build up to that record coming out and then the reaction to it?
Yes. And well, for us, it was like something, being that being the first record, it was, but the first record for Sleepy Time, but something that had sort of naturally evolved out of what we had been doing in Idiot Flesh. And so for it to sort of really come into have the focus that we were, the focus that we were, have what we were aiming for really come into its own. And in the year, you know, with that material, to be able to go in a way that we hadn't quite been able to do up until then.
I think when we made that first album, now we're all like thinking about what we're thinking about and trying ideas right and left. But when we made that first album, I feel like we had some bigger ideas about what we were trying to do with like pacing and sonics as opposed to just music. And I feel like it was, because it was a first album, it had a sort of a high concept feel to it, even though it's not, I wouldn't call it a concept album, but sort of we were thinking about how the music should be. We were doing meta thinking about it rather than just writing songs.
Coming from a place, as we had in Idiot Flesh and Charming Hostess, working with Carla to a certain degree, where it was very, very composition based and very, you know, a frenetic energy, which, you know, maybe necessarily attending the sort of the youthful ambitions, but all of us realizing that we had a strong interest in the music we were listening to at the time, a strong interest in texture and just the sounds of the instruments themselves, allowing things to breathe and build up slowly rather than come out, you know, at full speed within the first few seconds of the song starting. And so we all agreed that that was a goal. Not necessarily something any of us were particularly experienced or adept at, but something we wanted to achieve in our compositions, allowing room to breathe and allowing all these strange instruments that we had at our disposal, homemade instruments that Dan had going, Carla's unusual violin technique, all these things that to hang out and allow room for timbre and texture to be in the foreground. And it also influenced at the time by having spent some years at that point, many of us involved in Buto dance and doing music for the dance, studying the dance itself a bit, a lot of which is very patient, very slow moving and internal. And so it was a far cry from, even though in Idiot Flesh, we were already interested in that, but we didn't know how to slow down enough to take advantage of the drama of the potential for the drama of that. And that I feel like it's something we're always always a struggle to maintain that awareness of the necessity to stop for a moment and allow the impact of something to build. So that was sort of a conscious effort back in 2000 to allow those things to come into the foreground. Referring back to the maybe sort of surprising appeal of this music over this long period of time, I feel like there's a lot of interest in various strands of heavy music going on in America that is not very genre defined. And this is going on in a lot of forms of heavy music have been very sort of, their innovations have happened within genre forms. So, you know, the various sort of punk, post-punk, metal, death metal, black metal, doom, all these forms have all gotten very sort of specific in their sort of where they have stayed very traditional in a way within their genres, but then those staying very traditional and focused only with these sounds, only with these timbres, only with this kind of vocal approach or whatever, then those restrictions have allowed them to push so far in terms of speed and tempo, or in terms of, you know, a wash of noise in the terms of the production, or in terms of extreme slowness, or so all those different sort of areas. But then they get, because of that, they can tend to get kind of ghettoized into these little subgroups that for a long time had been sort of had their stance as being oppositional to each other. Well, if you're into this kind of heavy music, then you don't like this other kind of heavy music, or prog rock. If you're into prog rock, then you're not into this. And I think we've definitely entered an era within the last 5-10 years where that has blown open so much, especially in the States, where some of those genres have never had quite the sort of name brand power that they have in Europe, say, in terms of having whole festivals evolving around them. And so I feel like there's a real open-mindedness and a hunger for this really open-ended heavy music that can draw from wherever it wants, wherever it needs to, wherever it wants to. And that's kind of where we have been functioning from the very beginning, and before the beginning of Sleepy Time. We've always been not restricting ourselves to any particular area of our influences, which are of course vast. Everybody listens to everything, you know, nowadays it seems, and why not pull in elements from that and let it just inform our particular music rather than trying to do genre accurate renditions of, you know, whatever it might be. And I think people are really open to that sort of genre-defying music. In talking to fans, I find extreme, like really educated, in many cases, really educated musically in terms of the history of music. And that is, you know, something that people in the old days would do, you know, with having a good record shop at their disposal or a great music library somewhere. Now people use those things, but also, of course, the internet to educate themselves in a way that's can often be pretty pretty impressive for some people who are pretty young and they already know about so many aspects of the history of what has led into the music that we're making. So whatever works in terms of edumacating yourself nowadays, you know.
Well, I think too that just that sense of dynamics, and then also the way that, especially across these first three albums, you know, you see an evolution and a different character to each one of them, which was, you know, to Nils's point, was also that kind of thing. I think for a long time, people were sort of, this is what you do. If you're garage rock, you make garage rock records, and you don't deviate from that in any way, and it doesn't really grow. And that, you know, becomes stale pretty quickly, whereas I think you all, each one had its character.
Yeah, I was just thinking about the concept of axes being the plural of axis. You know, and within music, you can say, let's plot this along the spectrum of, on the one hand, extreme consonants, on the other hand, extreme dissonance. And like Nils was saying, many groups find their happy spot. You know, they're a little bit edgy or they're very pretty, you know, and we like, why not make use of the entire spectrum of consonants to dissonance? You know, go all the way to absolutely pretty and then go all the way to absolutely ugly. And similarly with like the spectrum of loud to quiet, the spectrum of pitch to non-pitch. You know, some of our songs feature a lot of scraping and crunching sounds, you know, which are like, you couldn't assign a pitch to them if you wanted to. So there's all these axes along which you could like describe aspects of the music, and maybe it's not necessary to limit ourselves to any particular part of any of those axes. I feel like ideally we would just be drawing from the entire spectrum of possibility to serve an artistic creation.
Yeah, having a large palette, I think, is a band goal. Just there's only five of us, but we want to have a palette that exceeds our grasp, kind of. So that's why everyone has like their own kind of textural garden stations in which to play. Yeah, so hopefully we can, you know, we get as much kind of variety of sound as possible, I think, is a goal.
Definitely.
Tell me about the homemade instruments. And what the, because that predates the band, right?
Just a little. I mean, I did make some homemade instruments that got used with Idiot Flesh. But yeah, we had some crunching springs, and we had a prototypical version of the percussion guitar. And I had a few other things that we were using. So yeah, that was an interest that went back. But it kind of really, it exploded with Sleepy Time, partially because I had some time to just not be in a band and just build instruments. But also because, you know, when Mo joined the band, he brought a whole arsenal of his own kinds of sounds, which were different still from what I was creating with my homemade things. And it really was, I think, an explosion of different timbres that we had available to us.
Yeah. What's it like to travel with those?
It can be awkward. The Sledgehammer Dulcimer has gone to Europe 4 times now, and it costs money and effort. So yeah, it is, it does feel like a little bit of a, you know, throwing up an obstacle in front of yourself to be hauling this kind of stuff around. But we stubbornly believe that it's worth it, you know, that the impact and the joy it brings to audiences makes it worth it. But, you know, when we started using homemade instruments all through the, you know, the days of Idiot Flesh, I would carry a fretless bass and a fretted bass with me on the tours, and I sort of decided, you know, the difference between a fretless bass and a fretted bass is maybe not worth it. I'd rather carry something that's more different, sacrifice that subtle difference, and go for, if I'm going to have a second instrument, make it be really different. And I also came to the conclusion, I built a sort of a solid body stand-up bass thing that I used to play with Charming Hostess and Idiot Flesh a little bit. And after working that out, I was like, you know, this is cool. But there are a lot of people already building an instrument like this that's better than what I've created. So from now on, I'm only going to create instruments that don't exist yet. You know, just let's the bang for my buck is to create something absolutely new, because then I get it sounds original. You know, even though none of my instruments are like nearly as versatile as a well-made guitar, they do sound original. Which, I mean, I'll just say one more thing on the subject. One of the things that sets this band apart is our commitment to the homemade instruments and our willingness to write around them. If we have an instrument, we're going to decide this instrument is going to figure in this song. And then we let that instrument sort of lead in some ways, you know, that this instrument, oh, you can do this and this and this. Well, let's make that a part of this song. Rather than asking the instrument to be able to play any piece of music, we write a piece of music that the instrument, that really shows the instrument off to its strengths.
Michael, were you going to add something there? Or?
Well, on this last tour, we did a sort of a version of Bella Ciao, an Italian protest song. And then with the new instrument called the all new lever action lever, I had to just figure out how to play it on this. So sometimes it goes the other way. You have to learn a traditional kind of melody on this absolutely absurd instrument. That you can get great results by that approach as well.
It's interesting being on the outside of this, not playing the music, listening to it. I wonder about things like how much is feel and how much is counting, and then how does that all kind of come together in the, you know, the body of the composition itself?
There is certainly lots of counting, but then within that, once those structures are established, there are also plenty of moments that are not counted and are sort of cued by something. There's a little space that opens up, and then maybe just a single tap cues us back in or something like that. And those kinds of things also evolve over time, evolve in the live setting, which, you know, benefits from the night after night touring environment where stuff can really change. And I really like that. I really enjoy, that shift that can happen. But something that was just, we've been going through recently in, getting this material rehearsed with Wes Anderson here on the drum kit for the first time, starting last summer, and then with very little rehearsal, and then just having a few rehearsals before leaving this spring, and now we're going to meet up again in a week or so. But having to go in and try to figure out what was going on in terms of the drumming and the meter and everything, he did a valiant effort to learn it all from the records. But those clues that are left there in the recorded versions could be interpreted in lots of different ways. Without a map. As we got together and started working with Wes, we realized like, oh, okay, he figured this out this way, but he, for this whole section, he thinks the upbeats are the downbeats now. And so we've gone through some, you know, some difficult learning and unlearning. Because it helps for us to all be speaking the same language of, okay, that's the beginning of the bar. We're going to start right from the top of, you know, and if there isn't a common understanding where the beginning of the bar is or who's got the ball at that moment, it makes it difficult. But so because this stuff has there'd been a long time in between with partial resurfacing of scores, and a lot of this stuff had scores. Some of them had fairly full scores. Some of the material had only partial scores to begin with, and so all that sort of archaeological refiguring out of this stuff has been very interesting process of sometimes little scraps of paper and Yeah, all of us flipping through notebooks, like, oh, we're going to do that. Okay. And everybody's flipping through these dog-eared notebooks to try to recreate these things. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Wes, welcome. Hello. What was that process like for you to come into this music and sort all that out?
Well, fortunately, I didn't come in totally cold. Like I knew how Nils and Dan and Michael and Carla all wrote music, like having worked with them before for many years in Idiot Flesh and Charming Hostess and Schloss. It took a long time though to get through certain parts because there wasn't any reference point as to where one was in a couple of instances. And so it's just like there were a lot of questions that I had upon the first rehearsals that I think it's getting a lot better now to the point of not having to count everything out and being able to get to the point of just feeling through certain sections of songs. But it was fun having to like in a way these guys kind of had to relearn material that they wrote because they had been able to play it with, just by feel for so long that that like whatever was on the page so long ago had maybe been glossed over a little bit. So when I came in, they had to actually like rethink, all these really specific parts. I think everybody was kind of relearning the song at the same time that I was learning it for the first time. So I don't know. It's been a great process, and it's just such satisfying music to play. And yeah, really, really fun bunch of people, everything. I love it.
Yeah, we were like forced to do like a musical audit of ourselves, kind of like, I've been playing this for 20 years.
You've been listening to a conversation with members of Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum. The group is currently on tour this summer. You can find out more about their tour dates and how to order their upcoming box set, Triptych, at sleepytimegorillamuseum.bandcamp.com. You can also order that box set at joyfulnoiserecordings.com and catch up on all the latest information about Sleepy Time Gorilla Museum via linktr.ee/sleepytime_gorilla_museum. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.